I recognize the gentleman from Wisconsin, Mr. Kassenmeyer, for purposes of general debate only and not to exceed 15 minutes.
Last virtually 8 months been engaged in this quest for facts, evidence, and for truth. And up till now, the American people have been very patient. And, Mr. Chairman, I want to commend you for stating tonight that we will proceed inexorably to a conclusion of these deliberations, notwithstanding the Supreme Court's decision. For I do not believe the Supreme Court decision will have or should have any immediate effect on our committee's deliberations. It would have been helpful to have this evidence before, but we do not. We are prepared to accept the moment of truth. And hopefully, Mr. Chairman, we can conclude perhaps even this very week. This being as far as the deliberations of the committee for many months is concerned, a concluding episode, I would like to take this opportunity to pay my respects to our professional staff. I am proud to claim that John Doerr and Richard Cates are from my home state of Wisconsin. And as well, I would like to pay my respects to Mr. Jenner from the neighboring state of Illinois. These and others who have so ably counseled us past months, I'm sure long after this matter has been put to rest, that we are concluding in committee this week, can go to bed nights secure in the knowledge that they have been faithful to their conscience and to their country. Indeed, if those legal advisors to the president in former times had such a view, the president, this proceeding and other proceedings might not have been necessary. I would also say that as the general debate progresses, and as the articles of impeachment are offered and debated, the specifics of the case against the president hopefully will emerge. But even then, in the several days and under the procedural limitations, we cannot hope to treat very much of the mass of evidence we have considered over these many months. However, the public is aware that these materials are now released publicly, television, radio, newspapers, news magazines have attempted to communicate what this mass of evidence means. And while we here will have but a few hours of your attention in terms of the discussion of the implications of it, the public release of the materials should help the public even more. Chairman, we've labored long and hard in an effort to be fair to the president and to those among us who must sit in judgment but may not share common views. We now decide how to vote for or against impeachment. It is not our duty to attempt to assess whether Mr. Nixon committed common crimes. That is a determination which must ultimately rest elsewhere. In my own case, my decision has been made. I have concluded, after careful consideration of all the evidence, that President Nixon must be impeached and removed from office. And I say this, whatever the record of the administration may be in other fields, notwithstanding. This decision was not reached lightly, nor was it made out of a personal animus toward the president. The process of impeachment is a drastic undertaking, not only for the Congress, but for the country and cannot be taken casually. I would also have, as I have thought many times, if Mr. Nixon were the leader of my party, if Mr. Nixon were instead Mr. Johnson or Mr. Kennedy, and had been charged with the same offenses, could I freely and with as much certainty come to the same conclusion? I have to answer yes. I believe clear and compelling evidence does exist and leads inescapably to only one conclusion. President Nixon's conduct in office is a case history in the abuse of presidential power. The abuses documented by the evidence gathered by this committee are numerous and will be discussed hereinafter as they have in part been discussed before. I hope, too, that some of the issues and charges which may not originally be in articles before us, whether they are on the bombing of Cambodia or the or presidential impoundment, be fully considered, and whether or not they constitute any final articles approved by this committee, they ought to be considered as a pattern of a whole in terms of presidential disregard for truth and for law. Mr. Chairman, it is important to draw a clear distinction between preserving the man and preserving the office. Mr. Nixon has consistently argued that this fight against the committee and the courts is designed to save the office. In fact, I would argue that this fight is designed to save one person, Mr. Nixon. Impeachment is the one way in which the American people can say to themselves that they care enough about their institutions, their own freedom, and their own claim to self-government, their own national honor, to purge from the presidency anyone who has dishonored that office. This power of impeachment is not intended to obstruct or weaken the office of the presidency. It is intended as a final remedy against executive excess, not to protect the Congress against the president, but the people against the abuse of power by a chief executive. And it is the obligation of the Congress to defend democratic society against a chief executive who might be corrupt. Justice Brandeis warned Americans of the dangers of official illegality. Quote, "In a government of laws," he wrote, "the existence of the government will be imperiled if it fails to observe the law scrupulously. Our government is the potent, the omnipresent teacher. For good or for ill, it teaches the whole people by its example. Crime is contagious. If government becomes a lawbreaker, it breeds contempt for the law. It invites every man to become a law unto himself. It invites anarchy," end quote. Mr. Chairman, in my view, Richard Nixon has shown disrespect for the citizens of this nation, and he has violated their Constitution and their laws, engaging in official wrongdoing. Society, through its elected representatives, must condemn this conduct. Otherwise, we will cease to have a government of laws. I will therefore vote for impeachment of Richard M. Nixon, and I do this with the belief that the House of Representatives will agree and that his trial in the Senate will result in his conviction and removal from office. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The chair is going to be compelled to recess for a period of time, and the chair will state that the meeting will resume at the call of the chair, but it's necessary that we do recess for a period of time. The cameras might be turned off during that time.
All right, so there ends the first round of the impeachment debate, or at least the first round of tonight's part of the impeachment debate before the House Judiciary Committee. Jim, I would say that two significant things occurred during this opening portion. First, we had Republican Congressman Robert McCrory of Illinois, who indicated that he is ready to vote for impeachment on possibly two allegations, at least as I read the Republican congressman. And the other significant revelation, I thought, was Republican Congressman Henry Smith of New York, who indicated he will not vote for impeachment, that he is only unsatisfied about one part of the evidence as it relates to the secret bombing of Cambodia.
Which is not considered, Paul, a key area in terms of a, in realistic terms at least, a key area for impeachment, which made that even more interesting. It looks also, I don't know if you would agree, but it looks like the push to stop the proceedings while this matter of the tapes as a result of the Supreme Court decision today is not really gaining momentum. Of course, we can't tell, but Mr. Hutchinson, of course, the ranking Republican, said he favored that. McCrory really didn't speak on that issue completely. He mentioned it, but obviously he would favor that, I think. Henry Smith also favored that. And then, of course, the Democrats thus far have pretty well followed the pattern that they were supposed to follow. Mr. Donahue saying he was in favor of impeachment. Jack Brooks is for impeachment. And, of course, we just heard Robert Kastenmeier say he was for impeachment. And so we've had no real surprises thus far. Obviously, everybody is reading these things to pick up little nuances for shifts and changes. Let's go to Carolyn Lewis and see what she's picked up down there. Carolyn?
Hello. Yes, this is Carolyn. I'm trying to report to you that the reason that they've cleared the meeting room that was that there was a bomb threat, and that's why the meeting was summarily dismissed. And if you notice, Chairman Rodino looked a little bit uptight when he dismissed everyone. There has been a bomb threat here at the impeachment proceedings, and that's why the chairman has cleared the room. They're now going to move in and try to check out the threat, and everyone was removed very, very quickly. Back to you, Jim.
All right, Carolyn, we can see on the camera that the now that there are people still, the cameras, of course, are still on inside the committee room, and there you see an officer in there in uniform. Looking around, there are other apparently Capitol Hill detectives who are also examining the room for the bomb threat.
We might mention, Jim, that there was a bomb threat when the Senate Watergate Committee had its hearings, and you remember on one mm-hmm. occasion the committee room had to be cleared because of that.
Yeah. Public television coverage of the House Judiciary Committee debate on impeachment will continue in one moment.
This is PBS, the Public Broadcasting Service. Washington Week in Review analyzes the presidency.
Yeah, oh, I think he does think the House will not impeach him. Now, you may think that's living in a world of self-delusion, but I think they genuinely believe that that is not going to happen.
Washington Week in Review reports on the Congress.
It's becoming increasingly doubtful whether the Senate will have time this year to try the impeachment trial.
Washington Week in Review discusses foreign affairs.
Kissinger goes up and down in optimism and pessimism. I think that's clear. He saw a chance to get a deal, and he said he'd stay a few more days.
With moderator Paul Duke, Washington Week in Review looks at the major national and international events of the week. From Washington, NPACS, Washington Week in Review.
This week's Washington Week in Review will be seen Sunday at 5:30 and Monday at noon.
Evening at Pops is back. Arthur Fiedler and the Boston Pops Orchestra with guest stars for another 1 o'clock.
Masterpiece Theater continues the Edwardian series with Conan Doyle, the creator of Master Detective Sherlock Holmes. Doyle, Los Angeles.
NPAC's live coverage of the House Judiciary Committee's impeachment debate continues.
Back in Washington now, as you can see, the committee room is vacant, except for some law enforcement officers who are inspecting the room. There was an unexpected recess of the debate by the House Judiciary Committee on articles of impeachment as a result of a bomb threat. Chairman Rodino recessed the proceedings, and that's what we are awaiting now. The room has to be, of course, fully inspected and all clear sounded one way or another before the committee will continue. At this point, we have heard 7 arguments in this first general round of 15 minutes each. Let's go to Carolyn Lewis. Carolyn, did you notice any surprises other than the bomb threat?
Jim, yes, indeed. One of the Republican members that we all expected might be ready to vote for impeachment of the president was Henry Smith of New York. Now, if you noticed, he said that he sees no evidence at all that the president has committed an impeachable offense on any charge except possibly the bombing of Cambodia. That was enormously surprising because that's been one of the issues we didn't expect to be taken terribly seriously by the Republicans or the Democrats. You may know that Henry Smith is retiring this year and he's hoping for an appointment by the Nixon administration. Whether that has had anything to do with his position, we don't know.
Carolyn, what did you make of McClory's statement? He also has been considered, of course, because he is the second-ranking Republican and has been very visible lately, also considered a key vote, whichever way he goes, particularly when it goes to the House, assuming that it does go to the House. How did you interpret his remarks?
He seems to be leaning for impeachment of the president, not on the issue of Watergate. Again, that's rather interesting. The reasons why people are leaning one way or another is really the surprise of this evening. But he seems to feel that the president has really insulted the Congress and has insulted the Judiciary Committee because he failed to provide evidence which the Congress demanded for the impeachment proceedings. And I think that could be a very, very serious charge, and I think it could be very dangerous for the president's chances if McClory does decide to go on that issue.
Let me ask both you and Paul Duke a question. You both have been watching these members of Congress, many of them at least, over several years now. It seemed to me that Peter Rodino, for instance, when he made his opening statement, he was much more eloquent than he was when this whole proceeding began 10 weeks ago. Same way with Hutchinson and Donahue. Do you think they've warmed to the oratorical task?
I think it was quite obvious. I think two things were obvious tonight, Jim. Number one, I think that they were aware that television was there in all of its living color glory. And I think that additionally, beyond that, I think that they were aware that they were addressing themselves to one of the most historic proceedings which we can have under our constitutional form of government. And I think the importance of that was reflected in what they had to say tonight. It's quite true that that Mr. Rodino was very eloquent in what he had to say. I think that all of these members, as they spoke tonight, it seemed to me, tried to speak in a statesmanlike vein. They tried to put the impeachment issue beyond partisan politics. I think, for example, it was Mr. McClory who said that as a Republican, he felt that he had to vote on the issue of impeachment not on the basis of what was best for the Republican Party, but what was best for the country. And as Carolyn indicated just a moment ago, Mr. McClory did make it clear that he felt the evidence was not really that strong in the area of the cover-up, at least insofar as the president directing and giving impetus to the cover-up, which, as you know, John Doerr, the committee counsel, had made much ado of in his arguments. But Mr. McClory obviously was disturbed about the president sanctioning wrongdoing in the White House or having some knowledge of wrongdoing by his aides. And he also was concerned about the president not faithfully executing the laws. Those things seemed to have considerable impact upon Mr. McClory. And he seemed to make it rather plain that he was ready to vote impeachment on those grounds. Jim, we have a news item which came in just a moment ago, which quotes the Democratic House leader, Thomas O'Neill of Massachusetts, as saying today that only a miracle can save the president. In an interview on National Public Radio, Congressman O'Neill said that he would now have to say that the president will be impeached by the House. Now, Mr. O'Neill is talking not just about the committee itself, but he is talking about the House of Representatives and suggesting that the president will be impeached by a minimum of 60 votes. And he goes on to say that there could well be a tidal wave that would hit the House, and he could be impeached by over 100 votes.
Was this interview granted, does it say, Paul, prior to the president's decision to give up the tapes or afterward? Or we do know. Obviously, if it was today, it was after the Supreme Court, the original Supreme Court decision, but we don't know.
Yes.
One point of information for those of you who may... that the faces may be new in this inquiry. When the picture would go to John Doerr sitting at the council table, you'll notice he is flanked by two men. The man on his right is Sam Garrison, who is the new minority staff counsel. The man on his left is Albert Jenner, who was the staff minority counsel, and the man who now has become a member of Doerr's majority staff. There is not a lot of time there for either Paul or I to voice over and explain that. But so when you see that shot again, it's Albert Jenner on the left, Sam Garrison on the right. Let's go back to Carolyn Lewis on the Hill.
I think it's interesting to point out that while we've talked about a great deal of the talk on constitutional issues, and you were getting that from the Democratic side, if you noticed, Edward Hutchinson, who was the ranking Republican, took it more to a political level, and he kind of made it plain that this was a political effort to remove the president. But probably more significant, Hutchinson did, in a rather mild way, ask the committee to please delay its proceedings on articles of impeachment until it manages to get the material from the court, which has been made available by the Supreme Court decision today. McClory also mentioned that, but again in a very mild form. And this, I think, would confirm that while the Republicans may make a gesture in the direction of demanding that there be a delay in the proceedings, they don't seem to be too anxious or too firm about it. And I think that that means these proceedings will probably go ahead regardless of what happens as far as Jaworski getting the extra tapes and, of course, as far as the possibility of those tapes being made available to the House Judiciary Committee is concerned.
Well, that touches on the very question which I wanted to put to you, Carolyn. Do you think that there is now a new Republican tactic of delay that the president's staunchest defenders on the committee, members like Congressman Hutchinson of Michigan, working closely with the White House, will now try to use the Supreme Court decision as a method of dragging out the impeachment process all the more?
Paul, I think what they're going to do, first of all, is try to see if they can persuade the president to make the tapes available. Now, that would mean that they wouldn't have to delay. I think they're going to try to work from behind the scenes. As I said just a few moments ago, the way they handled this, it wasn't a very angry, demanding, it wasn't an effort really to sway the committee to delay everything. I think that at first they're going to try to persuade the White House to voluntarily hand over those materials and perhaps to do them quickly. I don't see, at this early stage, any sign that there is a concerted effort to delay the proceedings, even by the president's staunchest backers.
All right, thank you, Carolyn. A reminder that we are in recess. The House Judiciary Committee debate on impeachment is in recess as a result of a bomb threat. We are graced with the presence of the prominent Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Barbara Tuchman tonight. Ms. Tuchman, Henry Smith, the congressman, the Republican congressman from New York, made a statement a few minutes ago, said, and I quote, I think almost, that what these gentlemen are about to do will affect our nation for the rest of time. Do you agree with that?
Yes. Yes, I do. I think, to go back to what we were saying at the beginning, that it's vitally important, as I see it, to begin to restore, so far as we can, if one can alter the course of history, restore the confidence of the citizens in their government, which I feel has been failing over the last period. Because when confidence in government fails, then authority, then power loses authority, because authority is only effective so long as people believe in it. And I think this is a very dangerous situation to get into. And I think confidence in orderly government has sunk to a low in, that certainly I've not seen before in my lifetime. I think part of the plunge is, not all of it by any means, but of course the great plunge that we all see now is the responsibility of Mr. Nixon and his appointees, of whom, did somebody say 18 have been indicted? I thought it was 8 or 9 or 10 or 14 or 11,
no,
or whatever it is.
18 who have either been convicted or who have pled guilty to various crimes, and there are another 6 that are still under indictment for cases that have not been resolved. Now, that's not just White House officials. That includes also former officials of the Committee to Re-elect the President.
Well, all those people are, in the long run,
correct, is it not,
presidential appointees. And it seems to me this is one of the most serious aspects, because when you have 8 or 18 or whatever it is, staff members found guilty of wrongdoing, the presumption is not that the boss is an Eagle Scout. I don't see how it can be. It seems to me that this group of men are the appointees of the president, and he is responsible for them. And
at the opening of the program, you made the point, which you've reiterated somewhat, that Congress itself is also on trial as much as, say, the president is. Were you not then taken with the fact that these 7 men who have spoken thus far, that I would say all but maybe 1 or 2 made the same exact point, regardless of what the outcome of this is, that Congress itself is also on trial? Were you not?
I was. I think they feel it, the seriousness of what they said, except for Mr. Hutchinson, who seemed not to be purely acting on a Republican Party basis. But everyone else did seem, as Carolyn is her name, said at the beginning, it would have a solemn tone, and that's, she was quite right.
Speaking of Carolyn, she has Congressman Wiggins with her. Carolyn?
Yeah. Congressman Wiggins, first of all, could you tell us whether you think there's going to be an effort to delay these proceedings because of the Supreme Court decision?
No, I do not. Our ranking member, Congressman Hutchinson, mentioned that in his opening remarks, but there's been no agreement, even discussion, serious discussion amongst Republican members. The only context in which a delay might have resulted was if the president had announced at 7 p.m. our time this evening that he was going to send post-haste material down to this committee, and then responsibly we should look at it and read it. But the court didn't order Mr. Nixon to send anything to our committee, and he didn't say he was going to do it. So absent some rather clear showing that we're going to get it, we obviously shouldn't wait, unless we're waiting for something with the assurance that we are going to get it.
Are there any behind-the-scenes maneuvers to try to persuade the president to hand those materials over to the Judiciary Committee?
Well, they haven't been behind the scenes. I think they've been rather open. This member, and I'm sure other members, have exerted such influence as we have, and turned out to be minimal, to get the president all along to send the requested materials down here.
Mr. McClory seemed to say this evening that he felt that it could be an impeachable offense that the president hasn't provided the materials to this committee. Do you think that that's a rather serious statement coming from such a senior member?
Anyone who says he might vote for impeachment is making a serious statement. But I'm not at all satisfied that Bob McClory will vote on that count once he's had an opportunity to reflect on the law.
You were wrong about Mr. Hogan, too, weren't you?
I realize that. I can understand his anguish and frustration, which I share, about not getting materials which we requested. But the question that we have before us is whether the president is to be removed, not by reason of his contempt of Congress. He's never been held in contempt of Congress. But simply because he asserted, and I believe in good faith, that the materials were either not relevant or were covered by executive privilege. And to punish the president by removal from office on the basis of that bare assertion without an adjudication of the question of whether he is in fact in contempt, I think is pretty grossly unfair, I would think.
Hasn't executive privilege been struck down virtually now by the Supreme Court decision?
Well, the Supreme Court declared for the first time a rule of law today. Now, if the president acts tomorrow in defiance of that, that's a horse of a different color. But I don't think it's fair to punish any citizen for not anticipating in advance what the Supreme Court would do in a novel question never before considered by him. The decision today does not strike down executive privilege at all. It simply says that in the context of a specific criminal proceeding, then there can be an in-camera inspection by the court.
Do you think that you... Thank you very much, Mr. Wiggins.
Okay, thank you.
That was Congressman Wiggins, California.
All right, thank you, Carolyn. Congressman Wiggins, as everyone probably knows by now, has been one of the president's most ardent defenders on the committee. I think on the basis of the discussion that was just finished between Carolyn and Congressman Wiggins, it might be well to read the president's words earlier this evening on this issue of confidentiality. He said, in saying that he was going to abide by the court ruling and saying that he was disappointed in the ruling, but he says, quote, for the future, it will be essential that the special circumstances of this case not be permitted to cloud the rights of presidents to maintain the basic confidentiality without which this office cannot function. I was gratified, therefore, to note that the court reaffirmed both the validity and the importance of the principle of executive privilege, the principle I had sought to maintain, end quote. And, of course, what court's ruling today, Chief Justice Berger said was that, of course, there was a right of executive privilege, but they said in this particular case that the right of executive privilege had to go second to the right of evidence in a criminal case, which was basically the ruling of the court. It did not, in essence, throw out executive privilege.
In actual fact, I think, Jim, executive privilege was dealt a severe blow today, and this may have been a face-saving way of the president putting it, feeling that he was left something. But I think in the eyes of constitutional scholars, I think today's decision will be regarded as historic. I mean, it was, after all, an 8-0 verdict against the president. And it was established by the highest court in the land that the president does not have the right to withhold important evidence from a court of law.
Well, but only... the only point I was making was that the court only made this reference as it concerned criminal cases. I mean, for instance, let's use an example of executive privilege where there was a civil matter of some kind that did not involve litigation, maybe before a congressional committee or even in a civil court. I think it would be thin. Here again, I'm no constitutional expert. It would seem to me it would be thin to take this decision today and say executive privilege of all kinds has been struck down. What do you think about that, Barbara Tuchman? Do you?
I agree with you. I don't think of judging. I haven't even seen it, but just from what I've heard, it seemed to me that they specifically linked it to the necessity of a court requiring evidence in a criminal case. They didn't. I don't think Mr. Duke just simply ruled it out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the fact of the unanimity is very impressive, and it's certainly gone against the president, and I think it will affect the whole mood of the Congress. But
yes, that's my point. I recognize the validity of what both you and Jim are saying, but nonetheless, the president has held, for example, that he had carte blanche, in effect, to withhold whatever he wished to withhold with the argument that there is presidential confidentiality under the Constitution which permits him to do this. And it seems to me the court was saying, no, that's not right. The president cannot do that. He is like any other citizen.
Right. They were upholding the primacy of the law over the individual, right?
Mm-hmm. But without throwing out completely the concept of executive privilege.
I would think so.
A reminder, of course, that we are in a break and a recess called by Chairman Rodino as a result of a bomb threat in the hearing chambers of the House Judiciary Committee. and we'll be back there shortly as soon as they give the all clear. Let's go now to Carolyn Lewis. Carolyn?
I have here George Danielson, a Democratic member of the House Judiciary Committee. Mr. Danielson, do you think there's any chance that the Republicans are going to succeed in trying to delay these proceedings, or do you think there's an effort to delay these proceedings until you get the Supreme Court evidence?
Oh, I'm sure there'll be an effort made to delay the proceedings. I doubt that it will be successful, though. Most of us realize that if the tapes had something in them which would have been exonerative of the president, he would have produced them a long time ago. And if they do not, well, then we don't need any more evidence anyway. So I don't think there'd be any real purpose served by delaying.
Do you think that there are going to be a substantial number of Republicans voting to impeach the president? What's your feel from inside the committee at this hour?
Well, I have to get my feelings back in line since the Supreme Court decision. As of this morning, I thought we'd probably have a total vote of 26 or 27, which obviously requires some Republican votes. I don't know what impact the Supreme Court decision will have. It may change that a little bit.
In what direction?
Well, if some people may feel that, well, now maybe we should wait and listen to the tapes. That's a guess I'm making. We do a lot of this sort of just by, we sense it, shall I say. And I still think it's 26 or 27 votes, but I just want to let the effect of the Supreme Court decision soak in for a day or two on that.
If the president said that he would provide the tapes to the Judiciary Committee, but of course, as we know, the Supreme Court decision only gives it to Mr. Jaworski.
Sure.
If the president said he would provide those tapes to the committee, don't you think it would only be fair to wait and listen to them?
Well, I don't believe that we should wait any longer. We've been at it for so many months that I think the American people are probably way ahead of us. There's really no one going to be hurt if we do not wait. If the bill of impeachment is reported out, and if there's anything of value in there for the president, he can still use them. It's not lost. They could be used, for instance, in a Senate trial. As a matter of fact, if he's really got some information he wants us to hear, there's nothing to prevent him from publishing them tomorrow. You know, he published, 1,340 pages without asking anybody's permission. He can do that yet.
Mr. Danielson, on another subject, Henry Smith of New York said he would consider voting to impeach the president on the bombing of Cambodia.
Sure.
Do you think there's much groundswell for that particular article of impeachment?
No, I'm really surprised. That was a total surprise to me, and I might say it was a total surprise, I think, to everyone with whom I've spoken. It might be very interesting. Father Drinan favors it, and Liz Holtzman favors it. I don't mean that there aren't several who favor it, but hardly anyone has believed that there were the number of votes necessary to make it practical to include it as an account. Well, there are a number who favor such an article, but I don't think anyone dreamed that there would be 20 votes for such an article, nor that there'd be 218 on the floor.
Thank you very much, Mr. Danielson.
Pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.
And we'd like to say for the record just once more that after all these weeks of deliberation, the House Judiciary Committee has had its first disruption caused by a bomb threat. And while the committee room is being searched and the committee members talk among themselves and with the press outside, we are merely proceeding with our own discussion here to bring you up to date on what has happened. There is a parliamentary development which has occurred inside the committee tonight, which is of some significance insofar as the impeachment debate is concerned. The number two ranking Democrat, Harold Donohue of Massachusetts, has moved to recommend that the president be impeached on the basis of two articles. The first would be a charge of obstructing justice, growing out of the Watergate case, the Watergate cover-up. The second would be that the president has abused his power, his presidential power, in a variety of ways. At the last moment, we understand, a third article charging Mr. Nixon with contempt of Congress for refusing to comply with committee subpoenas. This was merged into the second article. Now, by allowing this motion to be made tonight by the second-ranking committee member, Democrat Donohue, the chairman of the committee, Mr. Rodino, has established these two articles as the principal item of business in the impeachment process. They must be voted on before any other articles can be considered. And thus, they represent crucial voting tests when they do occur. In effect, the motion that has been made by Mr. Donahue tonight is setting the agenda for the impeachment discussion for the remainder of the week. I think one of the things which is involved, Jim, in the drafting of these impeachment articles, and there have been little huddles involving certain key Republican members and certain key Democratic members. They've been taking place for the past few days. And they have been trying to reach behind-the-scenes agreement on how to proceed, on how to actually draft the articles of impeachment that would enlist the greatest possible bipartisan support. It is, of course, to the Democrats' advantage to get as many Republican votes as they can. They recognize the necessity of having substantial Republican support to not only clear articles through the committee, but also to help in clearing the articles when they reach the House floor. But one of the things they're now doing is drafting the language. And some Republicans, I understand, have taken exception to some of the language which was included in some of the articles drawn up by the committee counsel, Mr. Doar, and some of the other members. For example, one of the articles referred to a malicious cover-up. Well, the Republicans are suggesting that you don't need to use such superlatives. You can merely say a cover-up and not use the adjectives to describe it.
Also, for instance, in the case of Congressman McClory, he made it very clear that he did not agree with John Doar's drafted article of impeachment, the charge that the president directed the cover-up of Watergate from the day of the break-in onward. Getting back to one of the points you made, it might be useful to point out what is considered the magic number in terms of where there are 21 Democrats and that they must be joined. What is it? If they, the word is that if five Republicans join them, this would ensure a much higher vote on the House floor. If three or less do, then the president considers that the president's chances of escaping impeachment on the House floor increase, right?
I had an interesting conversation with a White House aide the other day who told me that if the president lost as many as five Republicans, the White House would have lost the ball game. If they lost as many as three Republicans, it would be a standoff. If they lost only one Republican, then it would be a significant victory for the president. Well, I understand that Carolyn Lewis is standing by again at the Capitol. Carolyn?
We've just had word, Paul, that they have searched the committee room and they have found no bomb, and very shortly we will be going back into the proceedings. They are going to be searching everybody as he or she goes in, so it may take a little bit of time for everyone to go inside. But they have found that there was no bomb in the committee room. It just was a bomb scare and a bomb threat. So that's one point of relief for us this evening.
All right, thank you, Carolyn. Barbara Tuchman, I noticed while Carolyn was doing her interview with Congressman Danielson a few moments ago that you seemed animated and wanted to comment on something that he said. Now is your chance.
Well, I was interested, too, in Representative Henry Smith's surprising remark about the secret bombing of Cambodia, because it always seemed to me, from the start, one of the most reprehensible aspects of the Nixon presidency, not only because he did it, but because he lied to the American public about it. And also because it brings up, again, this question of congressional responsibility and failure of responsibility, because I feel that it's going to take a great deal of responsible behavior by the Congress to wipe out the absence of responsibility on the question of war all through the last decade. The failure of the Congress to curb presidential war making, when it is a provision of the Constitution that we cannot, should not, cannot, I believe, make war without ratification of a declaration of war by the Congress. Now that is simply, we've been making war without that for quite a while. And the so-called Gulf of Tonkin resolution to me was, you know, a shameful blot on the record of Congress, of just saying to a president, go ahead, do what you like.
But that certainly made, of course, that was during the Johnson administration, that certainly legalized the actions of the president, did it not, the Gulf of Tonkin resolution?
Well,
it did in a technical sense,
but what it really represented was Congress saying, look, we can't pass on this problem, we know nothing about it, you go ahead and do what you want, which is not what Congress is supposed to do in relation to the war-making activity of the nation, which is a very serious matter. And I think that's why I feel that both the power of the presidency and the balance between the power of the presidency and the power of the Congress is what is at issue, if not at issue, but it's being played out here.
I think we should point out, Ms. Tuchman, that Congress has taken at least one small step. Some people think it's a big step, but however you may regard it, in that it has approved a war powers bill, which is designed to circumscribe the president's activities in leading us into war.
That's right.
And to compel the president to come to Congress to enlist the advice and the consent of Congress before American troops are committed in a foreign land.
The Javits Act.
Correct.
The significant thing, of course, just in terms of the politics of this committee, of course, was that Henry Smith, a conservative Republican, raised this issue.
Yes.
As Danielson pointed out in the interview with Carolyn, it's been the anti-war people on the committee, primarily Father Drinan, Congresswoman Holtzman of New York. Those are the people who have been pushing the Cambodia bombing as a possible article of impeachment. And as Danielson said, up to this point, nobody thought it had a chance. It probably still doesn't have a chance, but it's, you know...
Well, as you suggested a moment ago, Jim, I think it's a curiosity that that Mr. Smith would mention this tonight, because it has not figured significantly in the debate, and I know of no one who has been in close touch with the committee who feels that the Cambodian bombing will be included as one of the articles of impeachment.
Well, maybe Mr. Smith is really feels sincerely
maybe
about it.
Correct.
For once, a congressman might possibly be saying something that he just believes.
Could I ask you about the fundamental dispute which exists over what does constitute an impeachable offense? As we well know, and as we've heard many times in recent months, there is a broad view about what constitutes an impeachable offense, and then there's the narrow view, the broad view basically being that you take a comprehensive package of presidential misdeeds or wrongdoing and you have an impeachable offense. And the narrow view, of course, is that a president cannot be impeached unless he has committed a crime for which he could be convicted in a court of law. How do you see that argument?
Well, I'm not a constitutional lawyer, but I would say that an impeachable offense is abuse of power. And I don't think you need all this business of the smoking revolver. An elderly friend of mine who's in her 80s said to me, rather plaintively, is very puzzled about this talk about the smoking revolver. What do they want? She said they want to see a murdering Pat while robbing a bank. It's not that you have to have some overt statement by the president out loud saying, pay Mr. Hunt hush money. And it seems to me that he virtually said that in the tapes that we already have read. But to me, it's the entire body of the abuse of the office, the bringing it into contempt and lowering of the whole standard of the office of the presidency. And it's,
of course, in all fairness, we must point out that what you have just given is what is commonly referred to as the broad view of what constitutes an impeachable offense. That is held by, you know, John Doerr and some of the Democrats on the committee. The other side of that is the narrow view held by the White House, of course, and some Republican members, which is that it high crimes and misdemeanors should be taken in a literal sense, that the president must commit a criminally indictable offense. And, of course, that, and you've just given the broad view. I think Chairman Rodino is back in his chair in the committee room now. There he is. The search for the, as Carolyn just reported, the search for the bomb proved fruitless, and I think we're now going to rejoin, and we will rejoin with the next man scheduled to speak is Charles Sandman, a Republican.
I think Mr. Rodino has just got up, Jim, and Carolyn is now waiting outside the committee room with Republican Congressman Trent Lott of Mississippi. Carolyn?
Mr. Lott, you met earlier this evening with Jerry Ford. Was there something very serious? He looked rather grim-faced when he met with you. Can you tell us whether you were leaning toward impeaching the president and he was trying to persuade you otherwise?
Well, we have a regular meeting on Wednesday afternoons of a group called Shouter and Marching. It's basically a social group of about some 47 members over several years. Jerry comes quite often, and we've had at least one meeting in his office. We discuss a variety of things, including some legislation before Congress. I don't think that if he left grim-faced, perhaps it was just that he was trying not to get in the position of having to say what might be said at 7 o'clock by the president's counsel. He did know he had not told us what it was going to be, what would be said.
I'm talking about the meeting that was held upstairs in Mr. Glenn Davis's office
right.
Just momentarily. Was that a social meeting? It had nothing to do with these proceedings?
That was a meeting of a group called Chowder and Marching, and we meet every Wednesday at 5 o'clock and quite often in Mr. Glenn Davis's office, and the vice president was there.
Mr. Lott, which way are you leaning?
Well, I'm one of those that's tried to keep a low profile, and I get very upset with my colleagues in the committee for making, I think, premature statements. There's just too much happening. I think we should wait till it's all said and done. Look what happened today. Maybe something else will happen tomorrow and change the whole direction of history, the whole direction of this proceeding at least. I do not intend to make any profound statement before I vote. My vote will be my decision, and I won't announce it before then.
Do you want to delay this procedure until you can get the tapes that the president has to hand over to the court?
I might say that all of you have assumed quite correctly that my attitude has been the president was innocent until proven guilty with very clear and convincing evidence. I'm sure your assumption that maybe I was leaning that way was a correct one. I don't know right now that I would want to say that the proceedings should be postponed. There are some things we can do. We can go on with this preliminary debate and then look at what happens. I think at some point we're going to have to hear this evidence and report to the House.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lott.
Okay.
Thank you.
Again, it should be pointed out for the record that Congressman Trent Lott of Mississippi is considered at this point, as he confirmed, in the against impeachment camp. The next speaker on the list, going by seniority, alternating Democrat and Republican, is to be, as I said, Charles Sandman, who is a Republican, a son of a Cape May, New Jersey milkman, was defeated for New Jersey governor last year. He's been an ardent supporter of Mr. Nixon and is considered also, as is Mr. Lott, a probable vote against impeachment. As you can see, Chairman Rodino is once again in his chair. But there are some empty chairs there in the committee room. Apparently, some of the members didn't get the word that the bomb recess was over. That, of course, is...
But it looks like they've pretty well determined, Jim, that there was no bomb in the hearing room. I would like to refer for just a minute to the role of Gerald Ford, the vice president, in all of this, which Carolyn was just... she was just questioning Congressman Trent Lott about that. There is now quite a bit of speculation about the role being played by the vice president and whether he is now working for the president's cause in a diligent way behind the scenes. For example, it's been revealed that the vice president put in a phone call to Republican Congressman Hogan before he announced his vote yesterday.
Excuse me,
Paul. Now we go back to the committee room, and here is Chairman Rodino, who has just banged his gavel.
Secret bombing in another country.
Where's Sandman?
He wasn't secret in that country. No, it wasn't secret in that country. It was secret in our country, in an open society where we have this.
No, we
the Congress has this.
Well, and I, we can argue about whether or not there was a state of low war, but it's a matter of...
There's Chairman Rodino on the screen. We didn't say too much about him as we started tonight. He's become a household name, joining names like Irwin and Baker from a prior proceeding related to this overall matter. Chairman Rodino, among other things, is the only poet and Italian opera lover on this 38-member House Judiciary Committee. And he is once again trying to start the proceedings again after the recess. Still some empty chairs.
Committee will be in order, and committee will resume its proceeding, and I now recognize the gentleman from New Jersey, Mr. Sandman, for purposes of debate only for a period not to exceed 15 minutes. Mr. Sandman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not going to attempt to cover all of the charges that have been made. I'm going to isolate my statements to the major charge of the Watergate and Watergate cover-up. If it were not for that, I don't think we'd be here tonight. I think it's altogether proper, too, to commence by making a little bit of a review on what we've done, where we are tonight, and where we hope to go from here. My mind is unchanged as a result of the Supreme Court decision today. I believe that this committee should go on with its work. There are sufficient votes here for an impeachment resolution. This everyone knows. In fact, there has been that many votes here for a long time. There's no use kidding anybody about that. So regardless of what is in the new tapes, a majority does exist here to impeach the president for some reason or another. Now, I think that to say that this is the most unusual proceeding that I have ever been a part of would be a tremendous understatement. The thing that amuses me is that as important as it is, and even though it's been held in confidence behind closed doors, what I read in the papers from day to day lead me to believe I couldn't have been here. I must have been somewhere else. We started an enclosed session, and we swore by everything that was holy that we would uphold the rules of confidentiality. That has been the joke of the century. There has been nothing confidential in this committee. Members of the other side have reported to the media every hour on the hour, some every hour on the half hour. We have become the first forum in the history of man to release to the public every shred of information we have before a single decision was ever made. When did that ever happen before? Never. But we've done it. And then when we think about releasing information, I'm wondering. We have released tens of thousands of pages to the public and to the media. To the media to destroy if they choose, and some people in the media like to do that. And this involves hundreds of innocent people. Where was the American Civil Liberties Union about that? Isn't it strange that they have been remarkably silent? But willy-nilly, we have been willing, through one method or another, to give to the media, whatever method they want to use it, every shred of evidence that exists. And most of it is not evidence. The interesting thing about this, too, is what happened the other day, just for example. One thing that apparently the media hadn't had yet was a large document that had 715 pages in it about miscellaneous documents. I was asked, and so were the other members of this committee asked, vote for this willy-nilly without the discussion of a single page or a single document. That's hardly the way you conduct a good hearing, is it? But that's the way we've been working. Fortunately, that was defeated. And now, Another thing that happened the other day, I raised a question which I thought was a good one. I wanted to know whether or not counsel could advise me as to whether or not the articles of impeachment should be specific. Should each article involve a singular subject? I thought it should. Counsel never opened their mouth. We never got that far. And the chairman hit the gavel, and under the table that went. So there's never been a decision even on that point. And from the law, as I understand the law, the articles that we've been handed tonight don't fit what the law requires, because here you have a general article of impeachment, everything including the kitchen sink. And this, they say, from the best information available to me, from some of the best legal minds in the world, should not be. I wanted to know, but I got no answer. Now, I have consistently said from time to time that the chairman has done a good job, a fair job, and I think he has. I complimented the staff, I complimented counsel, both majority and minority, but there's never been really much difference between those two. And I meant what I said then as I mean it tonight. But things started to change 3 weeks ago. 3 weeks ago, it changed from a nonpartisan inquiry into a highly partisan prosecution, if ever there was one. Now, let's see what happened. Better than that, I suppose I should do away with current events and get down to why we're here tonight. And I hope that this has some advantage. I really do. I don't know as we're going to change any votes. I hope we do. One way or another, I hope it serves a purpose. I can be persuaded if somebody, for the first time in 7 months, gives me something that is direct, I'll vote to impeach, and maybe that should be the challenge to my 36 other colleagues tonight, 37 others. Now, I want to say this at the very outset. This is not a case, as far as I'm concerned, for or against Richard Nixon. I ran for governor in my state last year, and Richard Nixon didn't help me one blessed bit. So I have no reason to feel kindly toward him. Now, secondly, this is the third time in my life that I have had to vote on whether or not someone should hold a very high office. And I think because of the coincidence, it's worth telling you a little bit about it. The first vote that I cast in my life as a public official was when I was the youngest member, newly elected, of the New Jersey State Senate. The first vote had to do with the seating of a Democrat senator. And if there's anything I think I know, it's the New Jersey election law. I listened to all of the experts from around the country testify, and at that time, you only needed 11 Republicans to sign a petition, and that Democrat would never sit in the Senate. And we had 16, including me. I was the only Republican who voted to seat that Democrat. As a result of a long investigation, it proved I was the only Republican right. He was seated. 16 years to the day later, I cast my first vote in the Congress. And that was on the seating of Adam Clayton Powell. What a coincidence. It meant no difference to me whether his name was Powell, Nixon, or what it was. I voted my conscience as I understood the law without the persuasion of the Washington Post and others. I voted as I understood the law. I was one of only 13 Republicans, and I did not want Adam seated. But under the Constitution, as I understand it, the Congress did not have the right to exclude him for the reason they set forth. I was one of only 13 Republicans who voted to seat Adam Clayton Powell, purely on a constitutional grounds. Only one of 13, and I may be one of less than that tonight, who knows? And more than that, who cares? I'm doing this the way I think it should be done. This is the way I believe I pledged my oath of office. And although there were only 13 Republicans who voted to seat Adam, the United States Supreme Court said that only 13 Republicans were correct because they reversed the Congress and seated Adam. Now, for the first time in my life, I have to judge a Republican, the man who holds the most powerful office in the world, and make no mistake about that. I look back over history and I try to judge what I should do here. This is the most important thing I shall ever do in my whole life, and I know it. Far more important than whatever happens to me as a result of this vote. And I know history tells me that 107 years ago, the country was thrown into a fit of hysteria. And in less than 3 days, President Johnson was impeached during that fit of hysteria. That has gone down in history as one of the darkest moments in the government of this great nation. And I don't propose to be any part of a second blotch on the history of this great nation. How was it all done? A hysteria that was generated. Should it be done? Let's not use some words by some great people. Let's use all of them and put them together. James Madison, among other things, said that a president should be impeached only for something extremely serious, which affects his capability to conduct the affairs of the nation. And because of James Madison, a word was inserted into that part of the Constitution having to do with impeachment. He wasn't satisfied that it could be any crime because he said it had to be a high crime, a serious one. And this is what I think we have to follow. I'm not a nitpicker. You can find almost anything that will disturb you. There's lots of things wrong. There were lots of crimes committed by lots of people. But were they placed at the door of the president? I don't think so. But maybe you can convince me in the rest of the time that we have to argue. And if you do, I will vote to impeach. But not on what I've gotten so far. Madison said that the president should be removed only for the most serious offense. To do otherwise would deprive the electorate of the right to select. To do otherwise would place a mechanism in the hands of a majority party that any time they choose, they could throw the country into a turmoil to replace the chief executive, and that should never happen. So it shouldn't be any kind of a crime. It should be a serious crime affecting the chief executive's ability to rule the nation. Some people say we're here as a grand jury. I think we're here as much more than a grand jury because even Mr. Doar has said, and I do compliment his ability as a lawyer, I think he's one of the best I've ever met. And one of the fairest that I've met, too, up to 3 weeks ago. But even he said, the weight of evidence must be clear, it must be convincing, and let's keep to those two words. You can't substitute them for anything else. Clear and convincing. Now, prove to me that they're clear and convincing, and I will vote to impeach. But you cannot and you should not, under any circumstance, attempt to remove the highest office in the world for anything less than clear and convincing, anything less than something highly serious. And this is what I propose to do. Now, many wrongs have been committed, no question about it. But were those wrongs directed by the president? Is there direct evidence that said he had anything to do about it? Of course there isn't. And what has happened in the interim? Fair articles like this. Reliable News magazine, I'm told. What does it say? And if this isn't trying to incite the people into a frenzy against good judgment, you tell me what is. Newsweek, July 22nd, 1974. The evidence. Only half of an extremely damaging sentence. It says, quoting the president, I want you all to stonewall it. Let them plead the Fifth Amendment, cover it up, do anything, save the plan. Terrible, isn't it? They left off the other half of the president, as did that very fair Washington Post, when they buried on page 20 the other half of the sentence, which quoted the president as saying, "But I'd rather it be done the other way." This is what has happened every day, every hour on the hour. So we don't have to do this in frenzy. Let's do it the right way. The first tape of March 21, 1973 worried me to death. When I went to bed that night, I made up my mind the president is cooked. He doesn't have a chance. But the following morning, I heard another tape that was made only 3 hours later on the same day. And that completely did away with what was happening in the first tape. So you can't use one tape as this fair magazine has done. You can't use one part of a tape as the Washington Post did. You have to use it all in context to arrive at the truth. And this is what I suggest we do. Now, it is not the purpose of any media to make the news. It is the purpose and the objective of the media to fairly report the news. Now, to say, as this committee did over many weeks, everything that Haldeman knew, Nixon knew, that's not proof. And I want to pose this one last thing. I wonder what the prosecutor in the United States Senate is going to do for witnesses. I wonder what he's going to do. Is he going to plead his whole case on tapes because he can't use any of the witnesses we had? Because every one of them testified no act of wrongdoing on the part of the president. And if you don't think so, go through the lot. Who was the man who handled the money? LaRue. Was there any involvement by the president? His answer to the question, no. To the man who received the money, Bittner, the attorney. Did your client make any threat to get clemency from the president or any of his agents? The answer, no. As to the man who supposedly directed the payment of the money, Mitchell, did the president have anything to do with that direction? The answer, no. Now, with these kind of witnesses, how do you prove that case before the Senate? Is there a soul here who honestly believes that 67 out of 100 senators are willing to accept this kind of evidence? I don't think so. And I think this is why we're here. Now, maybe in the time that is remaining, someone, somehow, will point out the fact that I'm only human and I'm not infallible. Maybe I overlooked something. Maybe there is a tie-in with the president. All right, there's 37 of you. Give me that information. Give it to 202 million Americans. Because up to this moment, you haven't. Thank you.